Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the this meeting of the Education Finance Division to order. A quorum is present. Representative Sandstead, have you looked at the minutes?
I am currently looking at.
You're currently looking. How are they looking?
They look fantastic. I move the minutes.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Sandstead motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Members and to the public, today is an overview on school nutrition programs and the impact of meeting students' hunger needs as part of their academic performance. In your packets for members are two sets of runs, one dealing with lunches and school lunches served by schools and other sponsors over the last academic year, and the second run of school breakfasts served by schools, and it's broken out by public and private schools, as well as, of course, as charters. So you may want to consult those as the different presenters come before the committee. With that, we open with the Minnesota Department of Education. Mr. Corte, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Darren Corte. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. With me as well is Deb Lukanen. She's our supervisor of school nutrition programs at the department. We're here to talk at a high level with you about school nutrition funding today. Have a short presentation, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. And I would leave it up to the chair whether or not you want to do questions as we go along or wait till the end. It's up to you.
Okay. We'll see how thought-provoking you folks are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first, I wanted to walk through the various nutrition school nutrition programs that exist here in Minnesota. We have 654 what the USDA refers to as school food authorities. So again, just as a really broad overview, the school nutrition programs that we administer are funded nationally through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So school food authorities, as the chair mentioned, could include public schools but also private schools. There's 2,059 school sites that are served under the program, under the various programs. The largest program that we have in school nutrition is the school lunch program, federally assisted meal program that, again, operates in public and non-public schools and residential child care institutions. Also, there's the federal school breakfast program. We have a Minnesota statute that kind of goes beyond the federal law that requires a school site to participate if they have more than 33% of their student population as free or reduced price eligible in the prior 2 years. So if you meet that eligibility criteria, you are required under Minnesota statutes to provide and participate in the school breakfast program. There is also the special milk program, which is a federal program for schools that do not provide a school lunch or breakfast program, but then milk is provided for those students. Another program is the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program. This is a grant program that's specifically targeted to low-income school sites. Fresh fruit vegetable stacks served in collaboration with as part of the curriculum. So this would be during instructional time, correct? And we see 1% of meals claimed, so 3.3 million for eligible schools that have at least 50% free and reduced price lunch population. The after school snack program is a federal program where a snack is provided after the school day is completed. Eligible schools that have more than 50% free and reduced price lunch population will receive a reimbursement of 91 cents per snack. If you have less than that, you would receive 7 cents per snack. We have the word ineligible on there. It's not all schools are eligible. It's just whether or not you're eligible to receive that higher reimbursement rate. There's also the Minnesota Milk Program. This is a state program that's in Minnesota statutes that provides 20 cents for one half pint of milk served to kindergarten students during the school day as part of a snack break. And then there's the USDA Foods Program, which is a commodities program that provides 23.5 cents in commodity food value per meal served. I know that these are a lot of programs, and they're all quite different in their funding structure and eligibility. So, again, be happy to answer any questions you have, but just wanted to give you a broad overview at this point.
Oh, sorry, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the pause. When you're looking at, like, the 91 cents is what a school would be eligible, does that pay for the food? Or is it just offset some of the cost of the school, of the food?
The 91 cents.
Ms. Lukanen.
Sorry. Thank you.
Quite all right. If you could introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you. Deborah Lukanen. I'm the supervisor for school nutrition programs with the Minnesota Department of Education.
Welcome. Okay.
Thank you. The 91 cents, the snack program requires the students to take just two items, and it's just an after-school snack program. It's not a meal program. Mm-hmm. You know, depending upon if schools can use the commodities or not, because they could use that, 91 cents could cover it. And it depends how many full-price kids they're serving, too, because that 7 cents certainly doesn't. So it depends what the blended rate is for that snack program.
Prior?
It could, but...
All right. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifiers. Of the two pages of programs that you have listed here, how many of those are federally funded programs?
Ms. Lukanen?
They all are federally funded programs. The Minnesota Kindergarten Milk Program, which is, it says Minnesota Milk Program, that was established maybe 20, 30 years ago, and that is the only one that is totally state-funded. The rest of the programs, there might be some state funding added towards it, mm-hmm. or there might not be. For example, the National School Lunch Program, the state of Minnesota, provides 12 and a half cents per lunch meal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kudishbudi, we do have
Mr. Corte.
We do have a slide upcoming in the deck that shows that breakdown of the state versus federal funding.
Great. There's a lot of variety on how the funding works for that.
One more question, Mr. Chair. Would you define what commodity foods are? Mm-hmm. When you say commodity,
yep.
What is commodity food?
Excellent.
Ms. Lukanen.
Thank you, Chair. Excellent question. The what a lot of us have remembered as commodity might be cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much anymore. And the commodity term is used very loosely. The more formal term is now called USDA foods. The type of foods that are eligible for schools to receive include fresh fruits and vegetables. It includes frozen vegetables, includes whole chicken, it includes whole turkey, it includes beef, it includes pork, it includes, there was like hundreds of different items now that schools can, we call it a survey, and schools survey twice a year. We provide a list of the different types of agricultural food products that are available nationwide based on the growing conditions, egg surplus, lots of Washington, D.C. things. We need to order on a per semi-truck load full. So if we can get a semi-truck load of whole wheat flour or brown rice, that's fabulous. But if we don't get enough schools to survey for that, some of the food products that we make available in Minnesota, it's totally driven by the school food service director's demands. So there are all of the grain products, for example, are whole grain rich. All of the fresh fruit and vegetable and frozen fruits and vegetables, the frozen vegetables would be lower in salt and sodium. The fresh or the canned and frozen fruit is packed in juice pack or light syrup only. Wonderful food. Plus, we have a whole array of fresh fruits and vegetables that are distributed from a local distributor here in Minneapolis area to the whole state.
Representative? All right. Thank you very much. Representative Edelson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So I was on our PTO at our school, and we were looking at, we worked with Hennepin County on food reduction waste. So under the National School Lunch Program, you're required to give students portions of specific options, correct?
Ms. Lukanen?
That is correct.
Uh-huh. So,
well, we're required to present and offer to the students a specific meal pattern that is dictated by the USDA.
Right.
Representative Edelson.
But they're also required to put it on their plate, if I'm correct.
Ms. Lukanen?
No. There are some options, and there's an option called offer versus serve. And that is, schools in grades 9 through 10, it is mandatory that the students be allowed to select 3 out of the 5 food components. The 5 food components are meat, milk, fruit, vegetable, bread. Very, very common. That hasn't changed since 1946. The total calories in a meal hasn't changed since 1946, but the where they're coming from, for example, the fruits and vegetables, that's our highest priority now. They're taking up more of the calories than the fat and the meat. So anyway, side. No, the grades 9, 10, 11, 12, off of versus serve, they are required to allow those kids to select. It is up to the school district to determine if they want to do the offer versus serve for K through 8.
That's great. Those clarifications. So districts have that choice. So some districts
have that choice. Mm-hmm. Districts in Minnesota are not mandated by federal or state law to participate in the National School Lunch Program. So this is a clearly a district decision to participate, and it is not a program for the faint of heart. There's a lot of regulations in it.
Right. Representative Edelson.
I just have one more follow-up. I apologize, because, of course, I think about food waste, right? So we in Edina, we did a program where we were trying to look at how do we reduce the amount of food waste. So we ordered whole fruit versus, the sliced-up fruit. So I think that's a huge opportunity that we're missing, but also anyways, I wanted to know the food breakdown, because I know that there's a requirement for breakfast and lunch, and it would be nice to see what that looks like, but I can look it up. Thank you.
Ms. Lukanen, any response?
I can send that to you, and again, with breakfast, it is also the kids need to select 3 things. There's only 4 required at breakfast, but in lunch, there's 5 things, and the kids are required to take, they are required to take 3 items. One of them needs to be a fruit or a vegetable.
Okay. Mr. Corte.
All right, Mr. Chair, moving on to our next slide. A newer school nutrition program that exists within the USDA options is the Community Eligibility Provision, or CEP as it's more commonly known. This allows districts and schools that have serve high populations of low-income students to provide breakfast and lunch at no charge to families in order to be eligible to receive to enroll in CEP, I should say, you have to have a minimum of 40% identified student percentage. Now, this is different than your free and reduced price lunch eligibility. These would be kids who are eligible for free or reduced price meals without having to fill out that free and reduced price meal application. So, in other words, kids who are directly certified because they're participating in another federal assistance program or state assistance program such as SNAP or MFIP. There's a number of other cross-categorical DHS categories that we work on through our data systems to automatically certify those students. So that's how you arrive at that percentage. Currently, we have 355 sites statewide that are eligible to enroll in CEP, and of those, 159 are enrolled. There's another provision called Provision 2, which again requires that a school serve meals to participating children at no charge, but reduces application burdens to once every 4 years, and simplifies meal counting and claiming procedures. And there's not eligibility requirements for that, but there is a procedure to enroll in the program. And right now we have 57 schools that participate in the breakfast realm only, and then another 3 that do both breakfast and lunch.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Corte, how is the data protected for these two programs?
Mr. Corte?
In light of the fact that the districts would know who these children are.
Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, as far as between MDE and DHS, we have a data sharing agreement that governs how that data is shared, stored, and protected. In terms of how that's communicated to districts, I'd maybe rely on Ms. Lukinen to talk about how that works.
Ms. Lukinen.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, just in the same way as if a family was completing a free and reduced priced meal application, they would submit that to the district office. And we do have confidentiality agreements with the schools and the districts that those that data needs to be secured. The students are who are eligible for SNAP or MFIP, which we get from DHS, then that list is, we maintain it in our database, and then schools can, via secure login, can tap into their set of students, and they would get a list, a printout, similar, it's not a full application, but they would need to treat that just the same as if it was an application coming from the family household. Is that what you're asking, or?
Representative Erickson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. But someone does know.
Well,
Ms. Lukinen.
Chair, someone has to know if the school, if the parents want to receive free meal benefits, if the school wants to participate in the program, and if the district wants to receive the reimbursement from the state and federal funding source, that is all tied to students who are eligible for free, reduced priced, or paid. And somebody needs to make that eligibility determination. In the direct certification, DHS has already looked at the income, the family, the income statements, and they've made that because they use the same income guidelines as the National School Lunch Program does. So security is a huge concern, so that these that no child is ever identified.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sort of a follow-up on that. So if a child qualifies for a free and reduced price lunch, but their family opts not to take advantage of that accessibility, how does the funding work? I mean, I'm guessing that DHS provides the numbers of all the students who qualify for some of these other programs, but if they don't take the food, how does that work?
Ms. Lukinen?
Okay, and there's a couple different scenarios. If you're talking about a family or a child who is certified that they're receiving SNAP benefits, the list goes to the district office, or we call it sponsor, goes to the sponsor. The sponsor has responsibility to notify all of the households, the adult household members, saying, we are aware that your child is eligible for SNAP. Do you want to participate? And they have an option of opting out. Otherwise, they will continue.
Representative Katiza Watun. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, members, as mentioned, we have a list here that kind of breaks down the state and federal funding for breakfast and lunch. So you can see there the total number of meals that were served as full-price meals, reduced-price meals, and free meals across the state. I apologize, we're missing a comma there under the breakfast free meals, but you can see between the 1 and the 7 there should be a comma. But you can see the federal reimbursement rates there of they actually do kick in 31% or 31 cents per full price meal, as well as $1.49 for reduced price and free. And you'll recall a few years ago, Minnesota took the step to fully fund reduced price lunch, so the gap between breakfast. So the gap between what the federal government provides, the state fills in that gap. And we also have for kindergarten, we have a provision in our state law that provides free breakfast to all kindergartners in the state. So you can see that line there of the number of meals served and reimbursement received from districts through state funds. And then as well as the free, reduced, and full price lunch rates that the state and federal government reimburse per meal. Then lastly, we just wanted to show you some trend data of growth in the programs. Obviously, saturation is much higher in the school lunch program. It's a much more ubiquitous program across the state, whereas breakfast, we definitely have some room to grow. So you can see there over the last 5 years, we've added about 7 million new meals per year. Hope to continue growing that number and increase it even more of a rapid rate. But that just gives you a picture of kind of where we've been and where we're going. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
Any other questions? Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who will answer this, is there any policy the state sets on collection of lunch accounts that are delinquent?
Mr. Cortez?
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, there's not a policy that we require. There is a policy that the feds, federal government requires, and I'd let Ms. Lukanen speak to that.
Ms. Lukanen.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, there is guidance, because there's a lot of guidance in the last 3 years regarding delinquent debt, regarding putting children in the middle of the tussle of it. There's a lot of guidance regarding working with families and notifying families. So we do have a few pieces of state legislation addressing the respectful treatment and no demeaning and shaming of students in regards to at the point of service and collection of meal debt. The statutes in federal regulations do say that the food service account, which needs to be separated, if you could kind of build a little fence around the food service account, needs to be separated from the other accounts. It's a restricted account. It's a restricted fund. It needs to be separated from the other accounts in the school district. Delinquent debt, or debt that is determined to be not collectible, can't be charged as a cost to the food service account. That's in federal statutes. So therefore, if you have a high unpaid meal debt, a couple of questions. When does it become delinquent? And the school district can decide. There are some states in the United States that they've made determinations of when the debt becomes uncollectible. The school district and districts in Minnesota can decide when that debt becomes uncollectible. When the debt becomes uncollectible, another fund must cover that cost and pay for the cost. Not the food service fund, because it's not the food services expense. They've already provided the meals and been out the cost. But that the food service funds needs to be reimbursed for that uncollectible debt, and that is in federal statutes. And that is one of the things that we've been struggling with for the last number of years, is that unpaid meal debt, for a variety of reasons, is still going up. And the last time we did a survey was in last spring, and I was thinking we kind of had a good grip on it, and we do not. It is still there. And it is not the food service's responsibility. It is against the law to have the food service funds cover that debt. So where does it come from? It could come from donations. It could come from those where you go on the website and crowdfunding, mm-hmm. or it could come from the general fund, which there has been a number of districts that is what the cost has been.
Representative Hewitt?
Follow up. So are they using means such as using collection services to go after these funds? Do you know, or would that be?
Ms. Lukanen.
Yes, that they can if they'd like to do that. A lot of districts use a lot of different ways. The smaller the district you have, the little bit easier it is to collect the debt, simply because if in a small community they can make phone calls. The superintendent can make phone calls. The principal can make the social workers can get involved. There's a little bit more closer contact. We have clearly seen some trends that the unpaid meal debt is less in some of the south and southeast and southwestern part of the states. It's higher in the metro area. I don't know the reasons for that. It was just some of the data that we've collected. It's unpaid meal debt is very high in the northeastern part of the state, and somewhat higher in the northwestern part of the state. And we have collected anecdotal information to get some, well, why? And some districts have
their policies set up that they will make continual calls to the parents. Some have superintendents or principals calling parents, which helps a great deal. Other districts just don't have those resources for a variety of reasons. So the unpaid meal debt, but yes, they can use collection agencies. We have a number of resources, probably 20 different resources on our website of things, best practices that other districts in the state of Minnesota have been using to develop a, first of all, to let the parents know what the meal policy is, first of all, so that they know charges must be, it's usually a prepayment. And then what happens if you run out of money, you know, what are the policies? And the USDA requires a meal charge policy be distributed to all parents at the start of the school year and then be readily available in a written format, not just online, but in a written format, just to cover all of our types of communities, so that the parents are aware of what the policies are within the school district. The policies in the school district are determined by their school boards and their districts.
Representative Hewitt?
Ms. Lukanen, Mr. Chair, Ms. Lukanen, could we get that data that you were just discussing?
Ms. Lukanen.
Okay. We are. We are in the process of preparing it. It was much of it is not anecdotal, because it's more than anecdotal, because it's a formal survey, but it was a voluntary survey, so it wasn't necessarily representative from everybody, plus it was fairly anonymous. But we can get that data for you.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder about the cost of the program. How have the contributions from the federal government increased over the last 5 years? How has the cost of the state increased over the last 5 years? And how has the contribution required from parents or families receiving reduced lunch gone up over the last 5 years?
Okay. Ms. Lukanen?
Thank you.
Good question. The U.S. government, the USDA, usually increases the rate of reimbursement maybe by a nickel, 6 cents, 7 cents, 3 cents, right around in there. So every year that, you know, goes up, and it's based on some heavy-duty calculations. The 12.5 cents of the state reimbursement has been flat for a number of years. I'm thinking, raise your hand back there.
It's phone a friend moment here. In the
yeah, it's phone a friend.
I would actually have to go back.
For maybe probably between 5 and 10 years, it's remained about 12.5 cents. What's interesting, and I ran some numbers right before I got here, is if we look back here on the rate of reimbursement. Is that what's up?
Yep.
You know, some people have to put glasses on. I have to take glasses off. $3.49 is the reimbursement for the free rate of reimbursement. The state average meal cost is $3.73. This is from last year's data. So we're short. We're short. How do we make that up? We can ask students to pay, and school districts, again, have the flexibility to charge $10 a meal or $5 a meal. Usually they don't do that because they're not going to get that. But there is a USDA requirement that says you need to be keeping pace with the $3.49, using that as a ballpark. That's about what you want to charge your full price kids, minus, if you look, full price, each of the districts get 49, or almost 50 cents per meal. So if the district is getting $3.49 for a free meal, then they're going to want to charge the students about $3. Now, a lot of districts do not charge that high of a rate, but that's really what districts would need to do in order to meet the meal costs, the cost of labor, supplies, equipment, maintenance, overhead, food, plus they really are losing a little bit of money, which is why a la carte programs come into place, because you need those programs to support. What's happening in a lot of our charter schools is that who don't have a la carte programs is that the general fund is needing to pick up
that loss. In a few minutes, you're going to see some wonderful pictures of school lunch today, and I'm so excited that my other advocates will be showing those, because it's a lot different than I think what we are maybe used to. So,
well, Ms. Burt and I had a debate. I thought that tater tots would be part of today's discussion, and she suggested instead the Italian dunkers would be the most appropriate thing. Representative Sandell, do you have a follow-up, sir?
One quick follow-up. Do you anticipate these costs and reimbursements to continue to increase over the next couple of years?
Yes.
Ms. Lukanen.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our presenters. Just a quick question, kind of a follow-up from Representative Hewitt's line of thinking there and curious about collecting debt. And for parents who are capable of paying, are there any kind of natural consequences that happen? For example, you said some districts maybe use a source to try to collect debt, but does it affect credit score, or is it similar to credit card debt? If you're not paying, does something happen, or what? How does that work?
Ms. Lukanen. Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, again, as I think Ms. Lukanen said, you know, it's going to vary on an individual level basis. I don't think that we have the knowledge of, you know, what the collection agency practices would be. That might be a question for a school district that uses collection agencies. Again, they're required to inform parents about what their collection practices are and their policy, but in terms of what the consequences of that might be, I don't think that we can speak to that.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick follow-up.
Certainly.
Another question, and this would probably be for school districts too, maybe, but if you have knowledge of it, is are we using, you know, as our school districts using more modern ways to pay? I'm guessing so, but even like a text message that says click here and you can pay through Apple Pay or whatever. How does that work, you know?
Ms. Lukanen?
Yes, and that is part of the listed on the website of our best practices. Is, you know, when my kids went to school, they had PayPal or PayPams or something like that. There are a lot of those kinds of programs. They're costly because they will charge, and then who is the cost transfer to? Is the per transaction covered by the district or covered by the parents? And that varies based on the different school districts. But that would be one of the first things that we would recommend for schools to do, is to get on a prepayment electronic plan like that, where with my kids I loaded $50 in the account, and when it got down to $2, it sent me a note saying, pay up. And when I found out my son was buying $12 worth of a la carte each day,
right,
I called the school and says, limit him to $3. And they can do that. You know, so there's a lot of flexibility and a lot of options like that. As Darren had said, we have nearly 700 school food authorities. About half of them are traditional public schools, and the rest of the half are a variety of charter and non-public. Some of them are very small and, frankly, can't afford that kind of a system. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Edelson, do you have another question?
I do, yes. Thank you so much. I think that, you know, what we're talking about here creates it could be a possibility when we have student debt or school lunch debt, that there's shame around food. Of course, I'm thinking from like the therapy standpoint of what does that mean when the child's going up to go check out and get their food, and at my son's school, you punch in your number, and what will pop up if you actually owe a balance is a red. And so that the person behind you knows that you have a deficit in your balance, and it's green if you're good to go and you have money in there. And so I think that this is a really important topic that we figure out how we deal with it, because creating shame around food for a young child is something we should all be concerned about.
Any response? Mr. Corte?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, yes, I think we agree that that's definitely something that we've been working with school districts on addressing. There is a Minnesota statute that requires that any meal payment reminders don't demean or stigmatize the child. Of course, those are, you know, subjective terms, and it looks different from district to district and even child to child. But again, you know, I think that the messaging, at least coming from our agency, has been, you know, if it looks, feels, or smells like shaming, you need to find a different practice.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah,
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. You know, my 34 years teaching, I noticed many times in the lunchrooms that many students brought their own lunches and from home. Is there any statistics out there, the number of students statewide or by district that bring their own lunches?
Ms. Lukinen.
I don't have any statistics statewide, but what I can tell you is I do have in the state of Minnesota about, I've got to take my glasses off again, 52% of the meals served are at the paid rate, 10% are reduced, and 39% are, roughly 38% are at the free. This is for lunch. So the folks or the kids who might be bringing bag lunches from home could be in any of the categories. I just have anecdotal information that the, and I think it's going to depend upon the school, individual school site, not necessarily district, but the makeup of the community, whether or not they, the parents are home to send. I could never, my kids had school lunch every single day just because I didn't have time to make bag lunches. I think we've seen a slight drop in that, but I know that there's going to be some districts testifying. Maybe you can ask that question if they can. But we've seen our school lunch, our lunch counts being pretty flat for the last 5 years anyway.
Representative Detmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Chair. Just thinking about food sources and sort of following up on that commodity food, is it possible or is it a negotiable for local farmers or local food producers to be one of the sponsors or one of the food providers? So looking at Minnesota, we've got all this, you know, these great dairy farms, these great beef farms. We've got bison on the rise, that sort of thing. Is it a possibility or does it happen that a lot of the food sources or some of those food sources are coming locally and supporting our local economy and our agriculture?
Ms. Lukinen, farm to school.
Yes. A growing avenue for school programs. We've got a lot of great examples, and I think that there's another hearing on another floor right now about that very topic. We have our farm to school as far as having students attend gardens or planting orchards is just burgeoning. We also have a number of districts working directly with the farmer to bring in their excess or odd-sized crops, such as tomatoes, that are maybe a little bit bruised, but the school district can turn them into spaghetti sauce and things like that. So yes, we have that. That is an avenue. We have just recently devoted FTE towards farm to school efforts in Minnesota, which we had to pull and push and wiggle and, you know, get that resource going. But it was an intentional move on the Department of Education side to add that to support this growing. And it's we think of farm to school as growing crops, but it is also, you know, beef and chicken and like milk. And of course, all of our milk is locally grown. So that's, you know, already in there. But even the USDA commodity, the fresh fruits and vegetables that we get delivered are local. And the distributor that we work with tags the ones that are farmer locally grown so that the schools can promote that on their menus.
Thank you. Representative Kunesh-Podein, I was able to visit a Minneapolis public school that participates in the farm-to-school work, and it was interesting. The watermelon radishes were interesting to the kindergartners or to the elementary students, but also they had the farmer there who was able to talk about the financial stability that a contract with the school district provided them and their ability then to better invest in the infrastructure they needed to preserve the food over, to hold the food over the winter months and the like. And so it was fresh produce in this case for the kids, but also economic stability for the farmer. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's so many topics that many of you know that this is of great interest of mine. And so Representative Edelson and Hewitt, I've got a bill that you might want to take a look at that has to do with the school shaming and the collections and that sort of thing. And Mr. Chair, I mm-hmm. believe you're talking about Washburn High School.
We were at Lindale Elementary, but the school district's lobbyist is a Washburn grad, so you may have just picked up a few points there.
I have the opportunity to go to Washburn this past fall and to view their program. And one of the points, and this isn't even what I was going to talk about when I asked to speak, but one of the things that was impressive to me is that fresh food is actually cheaper. Mm-hmm. It's healthier and it's mm-hmm. cheaper. So why not? Let's find a way to utilize that. But my question, as mm-hmm. we talk about this topic, generally somebody is going to say, I think that we should just make the hot lunch program free completely. We all know it's not free. There's a cost to that. If that were an option, do you have estimates of what that would cost the state of Minnesota on an annual basis?
Mr. Corte?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juergens, I don't think we have that information in front of us right now, but it's certainly something that we could provide to the committee if the state was going to cover the full reimbursement. We did it
last year. Representative Juergens?
No follow-up. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Joachim, one last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe it could have done at the end of your presentation, but are we also still running into a lot of districts that don't have cooking kitchens anymore and they just have warming kitchens? So when you talk about cost, I know that getting pre-made hamburger crumbles because you only have a warming kitchen is a lot more than getting hamburger meat that you can cook yourself. So are you seeing those trends change a little bit with schools going towards maybe a one location cooking to distribute or revamping their kitchens, or what are you seeing?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Lucan.
Yeah, really good question. The USDA over the last 5 years has supplied Minnesota each year with about $350,000 worth of equipment grants to address this. So that's really good news. And each year we keep wondering, are they going to extend us more money? And since 2014, they have been. So I am right in the middle of working with awarding this year's grantees specifically for that purpose, to either replace old, outdated equipment, some of which is more than 50 years old, or to purchase new equipment. And there was clearly a trend in the 80s and 90s to go with more convenience food because it took less labor time to prepare. And labor was very expensive. What we found, though, is that over time, the convenience foods are higher in salt, higher in sugar, higher in fat. And if we want to do the best for our kids and to serve them the most healthiest meals that we can, we're going to have to go back to that home prep type foods. Minneapolis was a great example of where even 30 years ago they were like they would make airplane kind of food with a peel-off cover and things. They have really now centralized within each of their school districts as much as their school sites as much as they can, rather than getting it from the big commissary type thing. So it's expensive, it's a slower process, and what we're really bumping into now is labor force, is that there used to be schools would have a sub-list 10 people long, and now there's no sub-lists anymore, and schools are working short, two or three people. That's one of the biggest concerns now. Plus, they want to do it by scratch.
All right. Mr. Corte, Ms. Lukanen, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. Obviously thought-provoking to our committee. Representative Juergens, one last.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly. Mr. Strom passed me a note, and he reminded me that Representative Thiessen had a bill last year for free hot lunch, and the estimate was about $150 million per year, which was, my memory is about $161. I remember somebody telling me that, so that's in the ballpark. Thank you.
All right.
That is correct.
$157. We're in the ballpark. All right. Thank you very much. Next up, a presentation on childhood hunger and health.
That it sure is, isn't it?
One of you is Dr. Yock, one of you is not, one of you then is Ms. Mino, if I have that correct.
It's Mino, Mr.
Mino, my apologies. Who's up first? Dr. Yock, please introduce yourself for the tape. Welcome to the committee. Proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Dr. Lindsay Yock. I am a pediatrician and hospitalist at Children's Minnesota. I am also co-chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Minnesota Chapter Policy Committee. I'm here today as a supporting partner of Second Harvest Heartland and the work they do to ensure that children have access to the food and nutrition they need to be healthy and successful in life and in school. We are here supporting the Breakfast After the Bell initiative. For context, I'll share a snapshot of our patient population at Children's. Children's Minnesota is the state's largest pediatric center, serving children from all 87 counties in the state and 60% of the counties in the surrounding states. We have two brick-and-mortar children's hospitals, one in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul, two general pediatric clinics, also one in St. Paul and one in Minneapolis, as well as 12 primary care clinics around the metro area. Last year, we saw more than 135,000 individual patients and had more than 460,000 outpatient clinic visits. Of the encounters we had, over 100,000 were interpreted visits in 70 different languages. We see an incredibly diverse population with 44% reliant on Medicaid. Because of the diversity of the patients we see, we know the unique and varied challenges our children face today. Many lack the basic supports we know they need to thrive, such as safe and stable housing, access to reliable transportation, and adequate, healthy, and nutritious food. We also know that 80% of what truly determines a person's health happens outside the hospital or clinic walls. The socioeconomic and social determinants of health are what really make up a person's well-being. If we can better control that 80%, we can have a greater impact on health and ensure that children in particular are set off on a good trajectory. One of the ways we can do that is to meet children where they are, at the doctor's office and in school. Last year, we started a program called Community Connect in our Minneapolis and St. Paul General Pediatrics Clinics. This program is a voluntary social determinant of health screening project that then connects patient families with multicultural, multilingual navigators. Our navigators work with families to identify their needs and help provide both short and long-term solutions to their challenges. Additionally, we work with our local legal aid to provide free on-site legal services through our healthcare legal partnership. Food insecurity is the most commonly identified need on our social determinant of health screening. Of all our families enrolled in the Community Connect program in 2018, 42% identified a need for supportive food services, with food pantries being the most common type of resource referral. We made almost 3,000 referrals out to food resources in the community in 2018. Just in the last quarter of 2018, the Community Connect resource navigators provided food resource referrals to 235 families. And research, as you know, shows that 1 in 5 children nationally experience food insecurity. That means that millions of children are entering school doors without breakfast, hungry and unable to concentrate. And these are just the families we know about, those who are comfortable sharing their needs with us. We know that there are likely many more families with food insecurity who choose not to disclose to their doctors. Because of stigmatization, families often keep their food insecurity hidden, and children may feel judged or embarrassed when using free and reduced lunch programs, which is why it is so important to make sure these programs are universal and available to all children where and when they can easily access them. We do that now through existing school breakfast and lunch programs, and we have the opportunity to do that in an even greater capacity through the Breakfast After the Bell initiative. The scientific and medical bases of the starring role of nutrition in pediatric health are settled. Good nutrition is essential for healthy brain development, which in turn supports the higher functions that comprise a life. Childhood is the time of critical brain development, and failure to provide key nutrients during this essential period can result in lifelong deficits in brain functioning despite subsequent nutrient repletion. Key nutrients that support neurodevelopment include protein, zinc, choline, folate, iodine, vitamins A, D, B6, B12, and long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids. Macronutrient undernutrition is associated with lower IQ scores, reduced school success, and greater behavioral dysregulation. Furthermore, we know that neurodevelopment proceeds by a scaffolding process in which the development of increasingly complex neural circuits and the behaviors they support rely on successful completion of previous stages of development. So optimal healthy neurobehavioral development requires that all necessary factors be present at their biologically defined time points and the no inhibitory factors be present. Research shows what we can sadly predict. that children who experience food insecurity are more likely to struggle in school, have lower math scores, and exhibit behavior and developmental problems. One study cited by the American Psychological Association included a community sample that studied low-income children ages 6 to 12 and found that children classified as hungry or at risk for hunger were more likely to receive special education services, have repeated a grade, and received mental health counseling than those children not at risk for hunger. The children classified as hungry were more likely to suffer from anxiety and exhibit aggressive and oppositional behaviors in comparison to their non-hungry peers. We also know the simple but hefty fact that childhood sets the stage for adulthood, and that risks for obesity, hypertension, and diabetes may be programmed by nutritional status in youth. These long-term issues are of great cost to society, and preventing them is cheaper and more meaningful than combating them. We do well to recognize the pediatric origins of adult health and disease. In addition, we know that our children have a tough job. We send them to school to learn how to read, how to write, and how to multiply. We expect them to socialize and make friends and enter to some of their first communities, which will serve as the foundation for their future civic contributions. All of this would be daunting even in the best of circumstances. Unfortunately for so many, we ask them to do that on top of worry about where their next meal is coming from and often at a biomedical disadvantage from undernutrition. The math in that old adage is simple. It's been said that children are only 20% of the population but 100% of the future. We have an obligation to make sure we give them the tools they need to thrive and lead healthy lives. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to take any of your questions.
Dr. Yock, thank you very much. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on the medical legal partnership that you're talking about. And so when you're doing the screening for the social determinants of health, is that a universal screening that you're doing for all families that are coming in? Or is there some sort of way that people are opting into that screening?
Downgraded you. Dr. Yock.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson. It's a wonderful question. To answer it efficiently, the general pediatrics clinics, I understand, to be screening universally, but our healthcare legal partnership is open to any families we serve. In my role as a hospital-based pediatrician working on the wards of the hospital, we ourselves are screening families if we detect a perceived need, whether that's immigration status, housing, other issues, family law. So some of that is our work and social workers' work to identify families who would like to participate. But on the clinic side, yes, I've understood it to be universal screening.
Representative Richardson.
And one more question. So when you're doing the screening in terms of what happens afterwards, and I don't know if you're able to get to this level of detail, mm-hmm. but how closely are you working with schools in terms of if you're identifying that there's food insecurity issues? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're able then to be able to connect with resources and maybe work with the schools to wrap services?
Dr. Yock?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair, Representative. My understanding is yes. This is a bit beyond my wheelhouse in the day-to-day application, but what I've understood is that, especially through that Community Connect program, our community navigators work with families to identify their eligibility and then link back into whatever next steps are needed.
Representative Richardson, I will share, since we take our son to Minneapolis Children's Clinic, mm-hmm. It struck me the last several times we've had him there, there's a large poster in the lobby, the waiting room, informing patients and families that if you need help with hunger, if you need help with legal support, if you need help with housing, if you need help with a number of, you'd probably call them social determinants, I see them as social supports, that the clinic serves as a resource and a reference point out to other community resources. And I've been very positively impressed that we go there for health care, but we would be able, if needed, to access these other forms of support through our medical clinic. It's kind of the full-service medical clinic model as opposed to the full-service community schools model, and I've been very impressed.
Thank you.
Dr. Yock, anything else? Or do we?
No.
Ms. Mino?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the, please state your name for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Rebecca Mino, and I serve as the manager of Applied Research and Public Policy at Second Harvest Heartland. Prior to my current role, I was a member of the Child Hunger Team at Second Harvest and was the first staff member hired exclusively to help schools expand the reach of their school meal programs to provide nutrition to students experiencing hunger. In this role, I work directly with school principals, food and nutrition services directors, and other school staff to implement programs like after-school meals and breakfast after the bell. This work helped reach kids experiencing hunger and informs my testimony today. I'm honored to join my colleagues representing organizations in engaging in meaningful work that is helping more Minnesota kids experiencing hunger with the healthy, fresh food they need to reach their potential. But I think we can all agree that so much more is needed to reach the 1 in 8 Minnesota kids facing hunger today. That's right, 1 in 8 kids in Minnesota does not have enough food to eat. The problem is not isolated to certain communities. It is pervasive in the Twin Cities, the suburbs, and greater Minnesota. The encouraging news is that hunger, especially among Minnesota's kids, is our state's most solvable problem. And we're hopeful that work in the community and the potential for action at the Minnesota State Legislature will help us make significant progress. The stakes are simply too high for our kids facing hunger in their daily lives. Last year, Second Harvest Heartland distributed over 89 million meals through nearly 1,000 food shelf and meal program partners in our service area. These meals reached more than 532,000 Minnesotans experiencing hunger. And of these 5,320 Minnesotans we served last year, approximately one-third of those were children. At Second Harvest, we are addressing child hunger in several ways, in addition to working directly with schools to help increase the reach of the school meal programs that I mentioned previously. Some of these efforts include providing grants to community organizations to help support their efforts to provide free prepared meals during the summer for kids through the Summer Meal Food Service Program, coordinating with partner food shelves and meal programs to source and distribute foods used in their school backpack programs, conducting outreach at school events and training school staff about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP or food stamps, to ensure that all families who are eligible for these programs know about them and have the support they need to apply for benefits that help make ends meet every month. SNAP remains the most effective anti-hunger tool that we have, since kids facing hunger experience their greatest challenges in the summer and on weekends when they don't have access to school meals. But more work is needed to end child hunger. The connection between health and hunger is a primary concern for us and for our colleagues at Children's of Minnesota. We're especially appreciative to their commitment to this work. According to the Boston Consulting Group, or BCG, children in the Second Harvest service area are missing approximately 30 million meals each year. The BCG study also shows that child hunger is not isolated to specific communities, but in fact is pervasive in suburban, exurban, and greater Minnesota communities, where awareness of the need and availability of resources is often significantly lower. For those children, the health impact of food insecurity can be devastating to their physical, emotional, and cognitive development. For example, children experiencing hunger are twice as likely to repeat a grade, three times as likely to get suspended from school, and nearly five times as likely to suffer from depression and suicide. Morally, most Minnesotans can agree that providing better access to healthy food for our kids is a must. But the direct and associated costs we face in poor academic performance, health outcomes, and economic output total more than $1 billion annually, according to the Boston Consulting Group. Our research and experience working with school districts suggests that one area for obvious investment is expanding school breakfast and providing this critical meal to students after they start their school days, and that will have a meaningful impact. Breakfast After the Bell is a program gaining more traction because it is simple and effective. Some of the schools in Minnesota are already experiencing success because it helps overcome breakfast barriers. Often students are rushing in the morning, because they were dropped off late or the bus only comes a few minutes before school starts. This leaves them little or no time to get breakfast in the cafeteria. Others avoid breakfast in the cafeteria because of the stigma associated with eating school breakfast. By incorporating breakfast into the school day, students no longer must choose between being on time for class or worrying about what their classmates might think. They just get the nutrition they need to experience a productive day of learning. Eating breakfast alongside their classmates becomes part of the normal school day for every student, just like morning attendance or turning in homework. In fact, breakfast is often eaten at the same time as these daily tasks. Serving breakfast after the bell makes eating breakfast every day an easy choice for students. In South St. Paul Schools, Second Harvest Heartland partner and operating a breakfast program after the bell, Principal Chuck Ochaki describes the benefits. According to Principal Ochaki, in our district, one out of every five students comes to school from a household that does not always have enough money for food. This causes students to experience persistent, chronic, and physical mental duress, which activates stress response systems, disrupts brain development, and affects other organs. It also increases the risk for stress-related disease and cognitive impairment over a lifetime. Implementing breakfast after a bell is an investment in both our students' health and our community's future prosperity. Teachers and school administrators like Principal Ochaki know that hunger is affecting their students and want to help them succeed. But they might not know that serving breakfast after the bell is a successful, evidence-based way to improve students' access to critical meals. We are working closely with the Minnesota School Nutrition Association to learn about and address these challenges of facing breakfast or implementing breakfast after the bell. Our experience working in schools shows that students who have access to adequate, healthy food achieve higher academic outcomes and enjoy better behavior and health. Above all else, they can focus on being kids. We are hopeful that this committee will prioritize child hunger during this legislature, and we look forward to working with you on pragmatic, meaningful legislation. Thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you, Ms. Mino. Dr. Yakis, thank you as well. We next have a panel of anti-hunger advocates. Imagine that. Representative Pryor, brief question.
Thank you. Just so I understand, so why is breakfast after the bell different program than breakfast before the bell?
Ms. Mino, good question, Representative Pryor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, great question. So it's still breakfast served through the traditional breakfast program. It's just the model in which breakfast is served is different. So traditionally, schools serve breakfast prior to the start of the school day in the cafeteria. So in order to eat it, you have to be there 10, 15, 30 minutes early. Breakfast after the bell incorporates breakfast into the school day. There's a number of models which it works, but often students are picking up bagged breakfasts and taking them to their classroom to eat in the classroom, or sometimes breakfasts are delivered directly to the classroom. So after the first day school bell has rung, students are eating their breakfast, like I said, as they're taking attendance, turning in their homework, and it's just part of the normal morning routine.
Representative Pryor, briefly.
The funding's the same then?
The funding mechanism is the same.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time today. Joining us is Colleen Moriarty from Hunger Solutions, Steve Krakava. I'm just here to butcher everybody's last name. I'll go after your first names later. And Ms. Fitzsimmons from the Food Research and Action Center. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed. I assume you've figured out who's talking first, second, and third.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Moriarty.
My name is Colleen Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. We are a statewide anti-hunger organization that focuses on hunger relief from birth until the end of life. And being so, we have cooperated and partnered on legislation to address the issues of lunch shaming, to address the issues of food and the availability of food through the food shelves, of which there are more than 300 in the state of Minnesota, and to utilize every opportunity to simplify government programs and move them forward, and assuring that everyone who's eligible is participating in federally funded programs. The federal funding source for anti-hunger activity is indeed the largest source of funding in the state of Minnesota and in our country. We have been working and growing the availability of resources to those in hunger in the state of Minnesota, but it still remains that 1 in 10 persons in our state are facing food insecurity. And by food insecurity, I mean they have no idea where their next meal is going to come from. These struggling families utilize programs like food shelves and government nutrition programs like SNAP and school meals to make sure their families are nurtured. When kids don't have breakfast that's available to them at school, it may not mean that they have that they're starting the school day ready to learn. This legislative session, we have a big opportunity to provide Minnesota kids access to nutritious fuel to fund their learning and to help them become and to close the achievement gap. As a state, Minnesota has missed our opportunity to adequately support school breakfast programs in the past. We can and should provide incentives to schools to serve high-quality school breakfast and to make sure that all Minnesota's kids are ready to learn. Of the 814,000 K through 12 students, over 120,000 students fall into the breakfast gap. They receive school lunch, but they don't have an access to a healthy breakfast program. Minnesota schools are leaving up to $12 million of federal funding on the table. Schools with high poverty rates can implement the community eligibility provision from the Federal Hunger Healthy Free Kids Act and offer breakfast and lunch at no charge to all the students in schools. Community eligibility reduces the administrative paperwork for schools and results in greater participation in school meals. In addition to that, we have worked to make sure that we close the gaps on some of the lunch shaming legislation that was previously passed, and moving forward that we have the kind of participation to avoid lunch shaming at any cost. Federal funding covers the cost of meals to low-income students, so schools with higher rates of poverty receive more federal funding. We can and we must fix the hunger gap for our children. Breakfast is ready and waiting, hunger relief tool that can be expanded in the state of Minnesota. Alongside SNAP, school nutrition programs are one of our largest and most effective ways to tackle hunger in our communities. This session, we can take a great step forward in alleviating hunger among our youngest and most vulnerable students. Thank you.
Thank you. Who? Ms. Fitzsimmons?
Fitzsimmons, actually.
Oh, Fitzsimmons. Pardon me.
There aren't that many of us.
I'll take refuge in that. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony, ma'am.
Of course. I'm Crystal Fitzsimmons. I'm the Director of School and Out-of-School Time Programs for the Food Research and Action Center, FRAC. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about two of my favorite things. First, the school breakfast program, and second, community eligibility. FRAC is a national anti-hunger organization, and we focus on increasing participation in the federal nutrition programs. I've worked at FRAC for 20 years, and I've worked with schools during that time to expand access to school breakfast and school lunch, and I'm very aware of the challenges and the opportunities there. As we all know, there is actually no silver bullet to improve academic achievement, but the school breakfast program is actually probably one of the best educational interventions that a school can implement, and it's paid for with federal dollars. Ensuring that students start the school day with school breakfast allows students to start the day ready to learn. School breakfast participation is linked to improved academic achievement, improved test scores, less absence and tardiness, better behavior, all the things that you want to see happening in a school. In other words, school breakfast allows students to focus, concentrate, learn, and behave. One of the best things that schools can do if they want to improve academic achievement is to make sure that kids start the day with a healthy school breakfast. Yet, the school breakfast program misses many students, both nationally and in the state of Minnesota.
We serve about 12.5 million kids nationally, school breakfast, and I'm focusing on low-income kids, kids who will receive free and reduced-price school meat, breakfast and lunch. And that's compared to the 22 million kids who receive free or reduced-price school lunch. So there's a huge gap there. In Minnesota, the reach is even smaller. There's about 160,000 kids in Minnesota who receive free or reduced-price school lunch or school breakfast, and there's only about 290,000 kids. And so there's 160,000 kids, free and reduced price eligible kids, are getting school breakfast in Minnesota, and 290,000 kids are getting free or reduced price school lunch. So there's a huge gap there. One of the things that we do at FRAC to evaluate states' participation in the school breakfast program is we compare it, school breakfast participation among low-income students to school breakfast to lunch participation among low-income students. And we actually set a national benchmark of serving at least 70 per 100. So it's a high goal, but it is definitely attainable. Nationally, we're at 57 to 100. And we actually do have two states that have hit that target, West Virginia and New Mexico. And we have seven additional states who are serving between 60 and 70. Minnesota is not quite there yet, and we do calculate actually how much money and how many kids are missed for each state when they do not hit that benchmark. So in Minnesota, if you guys would have served 70 to 100, you would have served an additional 45,000 low-income students breakfast at the start of the school day. Imagine the educational and health impact that would have for the kids in the state. Minnesota also missed out on $12.3 million in federal funding by not fully utilizing the school breakfast program. So there's a huge opportunity to draw down more federal dollars and also to make sure that kids have the nutrition they need in order to learn. And I also want to point out that Minnesota is not a leader on school breakfast. We rank states according to participation. In our last report, you guys were ranked 30th. In the report that we're going to be releasing in a couple weeks, you guys actually dropped in ranking to 32nd. You actually didn't decrease participation, really. You had a slight bump in participation. But other states are doing more to make sure that kids are getting school breakfast. And that's why your ranking is dropping, even though you're kind of treading water. So I know you guys are all thinking, if school breakfast is so great, why are we missing so many kids? If there's so many academic benefits, if there's so many health benefits, why are we missing so many kids? And Rebecca actually, I think, did a great job of explaining it. Really, there's two reasons why we don't serve as many kids breakfast, and it's because of timing and stigma. Most kids are not in school during the time when breakfast is served. It's served before the school day in the cafeteria. And at my kids' schools, at DC Public Schools, other kids are outside playing on the playground. If kids do get there early, they're hanging out with their friends, and they don't want to be the low-income kids who are walking into the cafeteria. So there's two ways to overcome that, the stigma and the timing issue. The first is what Rebecca talked about, which is making breakfast part of the school day, moving it out of the cafeteria, delivering it to the classroom, having kiosks so kids can grab it as they walk to the classroom, having second chance breakfast for high school students who wake up in the morning and aren't really hungry and just kind of roll out of bed and get to school. But lo and behold, an hour later in second period, they're hungry, they're starving, and they need food. So there are a lot of really great strategies to increase access to the school breakfast program. And we've seen school districts across the country, large and small, urban, rural, suburban, they've had tremendous strides by changing the way they do the school breakfast program, and it has a huge impact. And allowing children to eat at their desks with their teachers and fellow students removes the stigma, and it provides an opportunity for social and emotional learning in the classroom as well. The other important strategy for increasing school breakfast participation is actually to offer it for free to all students. Minnesota, I think, has taken a really important step, and you guys eliminated the reduced price copay for school breakfast and school lunch, and that's a huge opportunity for more kids to access school breakfast. But there are lots of kids who are just above that cutoff line who struggle to pay for the free and reduced price school breakfast as well as school lunch. And by offering free breakfast to all students, We also see that participation among low-income students actually goes up because it eliminates the stigma of participating in the school breakfast program. So that is another really important strategy to think about as you're thinking about how can we make sure that more kids in Minnesota start their school day with a healthy school breakfast. And the other exciting thing that I really wanted to talk about was community eligibility. At FRAC, we worked very hard to get that enacted in the state health, in the National Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act that was passed in 2010. And we have worked very hard to increase the number of schools who use it. It is an amazing option that reduces paperwork for schools and allows them to offer free breakfast and lunch to all students. So just to go into the weeds, I know we talked a little bit about community eligibility, but I think there's a couple basic things that everybody should understand, thinking about what you could do to increase the number of schools that are participating, because I think we all heard that more than half the schools who are eligible are not participating in Minnesota. Community eligibility, you have to be a high poverty school to participate. And the reimbursement that a school receives is actually still based on the poverty. So if you run community eligibility, it doesn't mean that you automatically get 100% free reimbursement for all your meals. You're still reimbursed based on your poverty, and schools implement it because it increases their economies of scale, because it reduces administrative costs, because they don't have to collect school meal applications, and it creates a huge opportunity to make sure that kids have access to food. So nationally, we have about 22,000 schools that are participating in community eligibility. The vast majority of those schools are actually really, really high poverty schools who are getting 100% or near 100% of their reimbursement at the free rate. But we actually also have lots of other schools across the country who are implementing community eligibility when they're only getting 64% of their reimbursements at the free rate, or which is the 40 to 50 category, or whether they're getting a little closer to 85%. But we're seeing that happen because schools are thinking creatively. And one of the important things that I really wanted to point out is we spend a lot of time talking to schools about how they make the different nutrition programs work. And we just issued a report on how to operate community eligibility at lower levels of poverty. And one of the things that every school nutrition director that we talked to who was doing it at a lower level, what they said was increasing school breakfast participation was actually crucial to making it work. And so these two pieces actually fit very closely and very well together. And those school nutrition directors all said that the way they increased school breakfast participation was actually by implementing a Breakfast After the Bell program. So it's a huge opportunity to think about how do we move the needle on school breakfast, and it also helps with lunch as well. So I just want to talk really briefly about what other states are doing, because states have moved in the right direction and a number of states have enacted legislation. West Virginia, which leads the country in school breakfast participation, they serve 84 low-income kids for every 100 who participate in lunch. They actually require every single school in that state to have an alternative school breakfast program, and they encourage schools to offer school breakfast for free to all students. New Mexico, who is ranked second nationally, they actually require schools to do breakfast after the bell and then also to offer free breakfast in high poverty schools. And I could go on and on. More and more schools are enacting legislation that focus on increasing breakfast through breakfast after the bell programs, requiring schools to do it, and moving on community eligibility. Even Texas actually passed legislation that required high poverty schools to offer free breakfast to all their students. So I challenge you guys to be the next state to enact some school breakfast and community eligibility legislation to make sure that your students have access to the nutrition that they need. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimons. Mr. Krakava, if you have a brief addition.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Steve Krikaba. I live in Edina, and I'm very pleased to be a constituent of Representative Edelson, who's on the committee. I serve on the National Board of Mazon, a Jewish Response to Hunger. I also coordinate the activities of the Mazon Advocacy Project in Minnesota. The project recruits the participation of volunteers from Jewish congregations from across the state. in support of programs to reduce hunger. We are a member of the Partners to End Hunger Coalition. School nutrition has been a priority for the Mazon Advocacy Project since it was organized in 2013. Our initial priority was to support the legislation that's already been referenced today to expand eligibility for more than 60,000 low-income kids, students, to receive a free school lunch. That bill also addressed the issue of school lunch shaming, and Minnesota became a national leader in attempts to deal with the problem. The problem arises when students who do not qualify for a free lunch, don't have enough funds, or even a deficit in their lunch accounts. The bill attempted to provide guidelines on what actions the school should take without demeaning or stigmatizing students. The Minnesota Department of Education provides guidance to schools to the effect that at no time should a meal policy target or shame students for financial considerations beyond their control. Districts should exhaust all options to ensure that students are not denied a nutritious meal. Regrettably, in the past year, we've become aware of reports that some students who are unable to pay are still denied access to the same nutritious lunch given to other students. They are instead given a substitute meal, and we support closing the loophole in state law that allows this to happen. We recognize that Representative Juergens provided leadership on the issue last year, and I'm pleased to learn that he and Representative Edelson are working on it again this year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Krakava. Thank you all for your time today. We're going to close out with two food service professionals, Noah Atlas from the Anoka-Hennepin School District. I'm told that's the state largest. They often point that out. And Ms. Smith from Westwood Elementary in St. Cloud. Ms. Smith, yes. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Thank you for coming down from St. Cloud today. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lori Smith, and I'm the head cook at Westwood Elementary School for the last 5 years. And I feed approximately 360 children lunch every day and roughly 185 breakfast every morning. So I find my job very rewarding and yet very complicated. If you can imagine for a moment what it must feel like to be a kindergartner and be so hungry that you sit on the floor and sob until we get food in his stomach, and then Adam eats with his friends and he's joking and he's singing, but this happens every day with our friend Adam. And then we have Isaiah, who is a fifth grader, and he doesn't like having extended weekends and holidays because he doesn't have food to eat at home. I see this every day at my school. So childhood hunger is a concern in our area, and we have a program, FACT, founded in 2017 by four Madison Elementary parents concerned about the effects of hunger in the schools. FACT is a volunteer-run 501c3 organization with three initiatives. They have the FACT Packs, the FACT Pantry, and Break Boxes, serving the students of Madison and Discovery Elementary School. FACT also facilitates a sponsored FACT Pack program at North Junior High. 80% of the students in the schools they serve receive free and reduced lunches. We know that the students receive healthy meals at school, the website says, but do they have reliable meals outside of school, or are they the 1 in 5 Central Minnesota children experiencing hunger? All children learn better when every child comes to class with their basic nutrition met. So I want to just talk a little bit about what I do at my school. At my school, I feed them breakfast in the cafeteria, but yet I make bags every morning that we send down to the entrance for the kids that come late so that they can take a bag, they go to their classroom, they're going to get breakfast. At 10 o'clock every morning, I put a tray out on my counter, which consists of string cheese that I get from Commodities, craisins I get from Commodities, apple slices that I get through a grant, and I feed the kids snack who don't have snack to bring to school. And so I'm just for feeding the kids. That's just who I am. I think the best commercial at Super Bowl Sunday was Oprah's and Hy-Vee's. It was. It touched. Mm-hmm. It touched.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Ms. Smith. You also illustrate the challenge that superintendents face in making the decision as to whether to close schools when there's inclement weather, because for some kids that means a day off of school and no breakfast or lunch.
Yep. No food.
So thank you, Ms. Smith, again.
Thank you.
Mr. Atlas, thank you. Appreciate your coming in today. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
My name is Noah Atlas. I'm the Director of Child Nutrition for Anoka Hennepin Schools. I prefer one of the largest districts. I am also the Public Policy Chair for the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. So thank you for having me today and giving me the opportunity to speak to you. As you know, the School Nutrition Program is a federal program. You might have heard that this morning. Created decades ago by Congress with rules and regulations administered by the USDA. As one of the many child nutrition directors in Minnesota, I'm proud to say that we serve over 98 million meals each year to our students. Historically, the rules and regulations around school nutrition don't make headlines, but the changes stemming from the 2010 reauthorization of the program became a major discussion point around the cafeteria and I'm sure in many of your homes. The Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act placed many new requirements on school nutrition programs, from the content of the food, how meals are charged to students, and what our guests must put on their trays when they go through the lunch line. The new requirements lowered sodium levels in meals by at least half, mandated only whole grain-rich products, established lower levels for low-fat foods, and created the requirement that each student must take a fruit or vegetable with each meal instead of simply being offered fruit or vegetables as an option. While initially these changes created controversy, over time our students have grown accustomed to the new menus and meal guidelines. Nutrition programs in the state of Minnesota have risen to the occasion by making more foods from scratch, updating kitchens, participating in farm-to-school programs, hiring chefs, and many other wonderful initiatives. The Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act certainly provided improved school nutrition standards, but it added significant costs to the local programs and to those students and families paying the full price for meals. Thanks to financial support from the state of Minnesota, school nutrition programs have had an easier time implementing the regulations. We're fortunate to have the 12.5-cent lunch reimbursement, considering most states provide little to no support for school nutrition. These funds are used to purchase higher quality foods and to keep meal costs lower for our guests. Minnesota school lunch participation is relatively high compared to most states, but lunch participation has leveled off, as you've seen. On the other hand, breakfast programs are vastly underutilized and offer a great opportunity to get hungry kids the nutrition they need to start their school day off right. As you've heard from others this morning, we know that students who eat breakfast are more productive, less disruptive in class, visit the nurse less often, and perform better on test days. We've all heard the stories about schools making sure students eat breakfast on testing days, but what if we treat it every day like testing day? This session, we're hoping to work with you to make breakfast a priority and help schools find a way to serve breakfast just before or just after the start of the school day. These programs are commonly referred to as breakfast after the bell or second chance breakfast. Why breakfast after the bell? Simply put, participation. Traditional breakfast programs do not work for many students. Traditional breakfast periods are brief, 10 minutes. A late bus, hurried morning at home, or snowy walk to school can leave a student with an unfortunate choice: get to class on time or get a breakfast and be late. We have seen the results from other states that provide funding for breakfast after the bell. Breakfast participation rates in these states have been reported as double or triple to their previous levels. There are federal dollars available through the community eligibility program provision that can make universal meals a reality in high-poverty schools, those that have a student body of 62.5% or more, directly certified as free reduced eligible. However, there exists a cohort of schools that qualify for CEP but are on the bubble in terms of being able to afford free meals to all students. These schools with a direct certification between 40% and 60% have significant numbers of working poor and low-income students who could benefit from a free breakfast option on their way into class. We'd like to convince you that providing state reimbursement for breakfast after the bell programs in these schools that are on the bubble is a wise investment. The legislature's attention to this issue and financial support would send a strong message to school leaders and the public that Minnesota thinks fueling young minds for the benefit of their education is important and will drive educational improvement in many schools. We greatly appreciate the support that you currently provide to school nutrition programs. and hope that you will consider this a major step forward in ending childhood hunger by making breakfast more widely available to our guests. Thank you.
Mr. Atlas, you get the last word. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all very much. With that, we stand adjourned.